It has been my privilege in recent months, working on democracy projects, to meet a great many dedicated citizens who spend time every year on the Hill, doing their best to meet this avalanche of lobbying and plutocracy money. So those who do so are my heroes, and one of those heroes is with us today. He is Fred Nathan, founder and director of Think New Mexico. Fred Nathan fought the tobacco industry when he was with Attorney General Tom Udall's office years ago. He's founded an organization now that matches facts with facts in the legislative process. His group is nonpartisan, but his sword is facts and research and a continued presence year after year in the legislature. Fred Nathan runs a budget that is over $1 million. He is serious about what he calls the fight for reform in New Mexico. Welcome, Fred Nathan, back to Our Times.
Craig, thank you. That's a lovely introduction. I'm going to have to make sure that my mother is listening when it plays tomorrow.
We are recording on Friday, the day before this goes live. So, yes, call her. She still has time.
82 years old, but she'll make time.
Well, I'm serious about this setting, which is that the facts and numbers are as powerful as any other nefarious things we usually think about when we think about lobbyists and their trips, paying for trips in the Bahamas. Those, of course, are not good. But what made us persuasive when I was lobbying for those guys was information, good information, reliable information, and to have somebody. Looking at the things that you've done in Think New Mexico, I don't understand the detail of any of those pieces of legislation. You got it all in your head, and you stay up there year after year. That is remarkable.
Well, maybe it's just our myopia, but we one of the advantages, I think, of Think New Mexico is that we only focus on one problem and solution at a time, and that is a terrific advantage that we can spend a year of our lives focusing on solving one problem and know it better than anybody else by the time we reach the legislature.
So what are you focusing on for this coming year, second under Susana Martinez?
Well, we've got two issues that we haven't gotten to the finish line yet. One is contributions by government contractors and lobbyists, which we believe would go straight to the heart of our problem with corruption in New Mexico.
Well, okay. So I've been talking about, and this program occasionally wanders into politics and occasionally wanders into plutocracy and the issues of control by big government. And we are trying to, in various ways, lots of people here in Santa Fe, trying to create an understanding of the larger coalitions of plutocracy, or that is the assemblies of great money that are running the country or gradually increasing. Piece in actual specific legislation. One of them has to do with contractors lobbying contributions, which is a way of getting at plutocracy where it fits on the ground. Tell us about that.
Well, as you know, corruption has been a long-time problem in New Mexico, and sometimes we think of it just in terms of recent scandals, but one of the things that we discovered in our research is that actually it's not sort of – this hasn't been sort of a recent anomaly. This has been corruption in New Mexico, which we've done. And one funny little anecdote is that it really does go back to the Lincoln County Wars and Billy the Kid and the Santa Fe Ring. And back then they were fighting over contracts too. Those were contracts to provide beef to the Army and things like that. And Teddy Roosevelt even became involved. He was a big fan of New Mexico because he had fought with many New Mexicans who were part of the Rough Riders.
Hang on just a second. Yes. Billy the Kid was involved in the struggle for corruption. Was he on the good guy side or the bad guy side? I mean, I just got to get this straight.
It depends. I tried to sort that out too, and it seems like there was good and bad on both of the sides that were fighting. So I'm not going to take sides on it. But again, they were fighting over
beef contracts.
Yeah, beef government contracts.
And
forward to New Mexico now, and we're fighting over contracts for investments. And then, of course, there's a big scandal there, and contracts on public service announcements from the Secretary of State's office, the big scandal there, and contracts to build county courthouses that ensnared a former majority leader of the New Mexico State Senate. So nothing has really much changed since the Lincoln County Wars. We're still, you know, mired in these corrupt scandals. And it seems that every time this happens, there's a lot of rhetoric and there's some symbolic gestures, but we never go right at the heart of the corruption. And I think that's maybe what separates this proposal, maybe why it's been so difficult to get it enacted.
So you have a proposal that does what? Let's start with that.
It's actually very straightforward. What we did is we mapped out these scandals, and the common denominator always appears to be government contracts, and many times the lobbyists are the conduits. And when you step back from it, you see, and your prologue was wonderful, Craig. I mean, there are these inherent conflicts of interest, and we're just saying lobbyists. And full disclosure, I'm a registered lobbyist. I like to think of myself as a public interest advocate, but I don't want to demonize all lobbyists. Some lobbyists, like you, you know, try to provide the legislature with good facts. From government. In this case, I want a law to ban political contributions by contractors and lobbyists. And so we just believe that contractors and lobbyists shouldn't be able to make political contributions. And this isn't a new idea. There are about 12 states that have enacted a ban on one or the other. Two states, Kentucky and Connecticut, have a ban on both. And the interesting thing is when we talk to them, they think there haven't been any efforts to repeal those laws. They think that they've actually been quite effective. And ironically, we were talking to a legislator in Connecticut who had opposed the legislation, and now she is its biggest proponent now that it's in law. And she related a very good story that I think perfectly illustrates her conversion. She had taken what she said was a modest contribution. I asked her how much, and she said it was $2,000, which I think by New Mexico standards is fairly large, from a lobbyist, thought nothing of it.
A contribution to her campaign.
So
we're talking about the first form of this corruption is, I suppose corruption stretches it out, but that's really what it seems to us looking in from the outside. So
yeah.
A contractor with an interest in getting a contract from the state makes a contribution to this legislator in her campaign.
Actually, it was a lobbyist. And then 11 months later, she's voting on some legislation. And as she said, you know, you'd need to have a Rolodex for a brain to be able to remember all the lobbyists that give you money and then the 2,000 or so bills that you're asked to read and understand. And she said, honestly, I didn't make the connection, but of course my political opponent in the next election did, and I had a very hard time explaining it, and I nearly lost my seat. And she said that made her understand that maybe it would be better for her protection and her colleagues if they simply didn't take political contributions from lobbyists, because as she says, it's just impossible to sort it all out and to assess motives and so forth. And now she's become, you know, a big advocate for separating political contributions from those who have a special interest and those that don't.
So you have a bill in the legislature, or had a bill last year, prohibiting government contractors, special interests, and those who are seeking major government subsidies on tax breaks. All those people are trying to get favors from government.
Exactly right.
They are prohibited from any kind of contribution to the campaigns of the legislators on either side, I suppose, challengers and incumbents.
True. Right.
And that that you, did I hear you say there were two kinds of bans?
But just from two sources. One are lobbyists and the other are government contractors. So people who are seeking a contract or a subsidy from state government and lobbyists.
So and banning them across the board, can't do it. And there is currently a gift tax in place that bans contributions above, what, $250?
I think that's right. And that's a great point, Craig, because one of the things that we tried to point out to the legislature in passing this is that they had just recently passed this gift ban. And if you think it's inappropriate for a legislator or a statewide elected official to receive a gift over $250, why is it okay then for that same entity to be able to make a political contribution in a single election cycle of $10,000, 5,000 primary, 5,000 general? So it seems somewhat inconsistent. So that was one of the arguments that we were making.
So you're saying,
so gifts are
gifts, you can't get a gift. You can't give them a package in a box.
But you can make an enormous political contribution, which is a gift of another sort.
So clearly, it's a gift of re-election.
Right.
Yeah. So this is a corruption issue. I mean, it feels like, smells like, if it walks like a dog, talks like a dog, it's probably a dog. So this feels like corruption. And that if, but here's a lady in Connecticut who says, you know, and they all say, gosh, I didn't know where that money came from. I was just voting my conscience. And you're saying, well, that doesn't sound really persuasive. That in fact, it'd be easier to believe that if you just didn't get any money from these interests.
And she reluctantly came to that same conclusion, that it would just be easier and cleaner if there weren't contributions and you had to sort out these ethical dilemmas and conflicts and so forth.
You pointed out at the beginning of this paragraph in this conversation, yeah. you pointed out that there were a series of scandals in New Mexico politics right now.
Yes.
And you pointed to various offices, and I couldn't get my pencil fast enough to write them down, which is sort of discouraging in itself. So tracing forward from Billy the Kid,
right.
We have a current day situation in
I would say scandals.
Yeah. And then I've got a follow-up question to that. So the scandals are in which offices now?
Some
of us don't read. We read Sports Beach first.
Yeah, and Craig, we could take up the rest of the show as I could recount all the scandals going back to statehood. But just in the last few years, there was the one in the treasurer's office where the two former treasurers were receiving kickbacks from investment advisors of state monies that they'd given contracts to, and they both got indicted and
so
convicted.
That is outright straightforward corruption. They weren't contributing to campaigns. They were just giving you kicks back if you gave us the business.
But that's an important point. That's where this starts. You know, we tend to think of our campaign finance system separately from our procurement system. But in reality, they're very closely related because what happens is, and this may be true of both of these particular treasurers, they ran for statewide office, and I would be willing to give them the benefit of the doubt that they started off with good intentions, and almost all candidates do, and they're in it for the right reasons. And then I think they're somewhat naive about how expensive it is to run for public office. And now their ego is – they've announced for office. Their ego's wrapped up in it. They don't want to lose in front of families and friends. And they see they have this deficit of money that they need. And who should present themselves but a lobbyist or a government contractor who befriends them? And this is a pattern that's been repeated over and over. And says, look, you know, you need to raise X amount of dollars. Let me have a party for you with my friends. And the process begins right there.
So let's make this vivid. So I'm running for state treasurer, and I'm going to be – the state treasurer's job is to invest the state's money. So it's just sit in a savings account, but it's actually out there invested when we're not – until we spend it. So we're looking for the best possible return on – rate of return on – we got estates billions that we can invest. We're going to make some money. So they have quite a lot of money to make if they can handle the investments of the state of New Mexico. And they walk up to candidate Nathan and say, hey, you know, Fred, we just think you're a really good guy. And we'll throw a party for you and see what we can raise. See if Fred gets elected. And Fred says now let's see. I've got this array of people to invest the state of New Mexico's money with, and then. But it didn't stop there, right? I mean, it's in this
right.
In the treasurer's case. Additional payments if the treasurer would invest in their houses.
Right, and usually they both insist that it's just a coincidence that it has nothing to do with each other. But as you point out, there's a whole array of people that provide these services, and lo and behold, it tends to be the people. Robert Vigil case, who was the first treasurer that got indicted and convicted, the feds actually had Vigil on tape accepting, I believe it was something like $12,000 in cash in an automobile at the airport. And Mr. Vigil was charged, I believe, on 24 counts of corruption. And his defense, Craig, was fascinating. He said it was a political contribution.
Perfect disguise. So it's okay if it's a political contribution, it's legal.
Right. And so exactly right. And he got off on 23 of 24 counts. And I think this perfectly illustrates the very thin line between legal political contributions and illegal bribes. And I should point out, because the current treasurer is James Lewis, who's terrific, and he's come in there and with the help of Doug Brown, who preceded him, cleaned up the problems that were there. I don't want to slander our current state treasurer, who's doing a fine job.
We have to take a break. You're listening to Our Times. Craig Barnes. We're talking to Fred Nathan of Think New Mexico. And we are going to investigate a little bit further the details of these stories of corruption and how they might be addressed. We'll be right back after this short break. And we're back. And we're talking to Fred Nathan of Think New Mexico. And you're listening to Our Times on KSFR. Fred, I've got you to pin down the one scandal, make it vivid with real people. Mm-hmm. So there we are in the state treasurer's office. That was headline news. But you pointed out it's several others, and these in general go to contributions. It's kind of a blur of corruption.
The other one that's gotten an enormous amount of attention involved former Senator Manny Aragon, and this was involving the construction of a courthouse in Albuquerque. And in this particular case, the contractors, architects, there was a lobbyist involved, former mayor of Albuquerque, Ken Schultz, was the bag man. He was acting, he was a lobbyist, not mayor of Albuquerque. And basically what happened was they got a state senator, Manny Aragon, to add money to a contract through a legislative appropriation, and they had false invoices between the architect and some of the other subcontractors. And that money was going to the senator and another gentleman who was the county, the top administrator for the Bernalillo court system.
Was there an actual conviction in this case?
Yes, they were all convicted.
So
we're
not just alleging this. We're not making this up. So.
No more allegations. They admitted to it. They're serving time. Ken Schultz is the lobbyist who was involved is in jail. Senator Manny Aragon is in jail. The architect is in jail. And the county courthouse administrator, whose name is escaping me right now, is in jail. So
we're not we don't have to use the word alleged in front of every one of these allegations, because it's been they've been convictions. So here we have cases of a blurred line between what might have been a campaign contribution. In the Manny Aragon case, it appears to have been directly with fraudulent invoices and all,
right.
Hard to disguise as a campaign contribution. Here it was just outright kickback corruption,
right.
pay to play. So your bill, now with those two famous cases, and then I love this traces all the way back to Billy the Kid.
Yeah.
it suggests that we are up against, and there is a reputation in our state of a reputation which may or may not be deserved of corruption in state government. Bill Richardson has struggled against that or been a mm-hmm. part of that. We don't know, but so far no specifics. But there is a kind of a fog that hangs over the Capitol. And are you up against a general culture of corruption, or are we up against a few bad apples?
I tend to think it's more a few bad apples. I think, and I interact with legislators all the time, I think most of them are in it for the right reasons. I'm particularly fond of our local delegation here in Santa Fe.
Brian Egolf, Peter Wirth.
Yeah, they're all doing good work and they're in it for the right reasons. book. And, you know, the New York Times tried to do a ranking of states on corruption, and I believe New Mexico came out third highest.
And in the amount of corruption?
In the amount of corruption. And it was an interesting methodology because it's really a hard, difficult thing to get your arms around. But they asked the same questions of political reporters in all 50 states and then figured those were the people that were in the best position to know since they're observing all the time. And we came out pretty high.
When was that?
That was only about 2 or 3 years ago.
That's quite discouraging.
So that's discouraging. And that's why we think that we need something a little more dramatic and a little more comprehensive that goes systemically at the problem and addresses it in that way. And as I said, you know, the common denominator always appears to be government contracts. And I think as government continues to grow, there are more and more contracts and they're more and more valuable. And there's always going to be a temptation to cut corners. And we'd like to have a prophylactic, preventative approach at the front end and keep keep lobbyists and contractors away from the campaign finance system, which is where it begins. You know, a critic of our legislation might say, well, what's the problem? These people did get convicted. They did, you know, they got indicted and convicted. But we'd like to prevent these relationships from forming. And, you know, the lobbyists in those states that don't have to make political contributions, many of them say to us that they feel, you know, shaken down for contributions. They'd prefer to make their arguments based on the merits. And I can tell you from my own personal observation, again, I don't want to demonize lobbyists, but I think most lobbyists in New Mexico would prefer this system. They want to win on the merits of their arguments rather than on their contributions. And the same thing with most government contractors. If you really have confidence in your product or service, you want to compete based on price or quality. And I know specifically when we came out with this report, a gentleman from Albuquerque called us up, and he's in the business of beautifying highways. And interestingly, he has contracts with all our neighboring states, but he told me he never bids on contracts in New Mexico because his perception is that it goes to the highest political bidder, and he wanted to compete based on, you know, the quality of his work. And so he was very enthusiastic about this legislation and pointed out that if we were able to get this through, that he would then compete for business in New Mexico. And that's another whole aspect of this, Craig, is that we as taxpayers are all losers in this system until we can correct it, because we're paying as taxpayers more for these services when there are these corruptions, because it makes these contracts more expensive than they would otherwise be.
Because they pay not only the value of the service, but the value of the corruption, the value
the kickback
of the
kickback, whatever it is. It's exactly right.
And I can see how this might appeal to lobbyists, because they would then be in a way on an open playing field, whereas when you're making these kickbacks and false invoices and having to say, "I'll come see you on Sunday" as in a walk in the park, you have to do that in secret. And so lobbyist A doesn't know what lobbyist B is doing in secret. It's not an open game. You don't have a chance to compete and are done in by that. That's a form of corruption which is absolutely pandemic in the former Soviet Union countries with which I'm familiar. Right. So yeah, I can see how lobbyists would be quite favorably impressed with the opportunity, especially the table and say, look at these services. These are competitive. Your bill was fairly successful in the House last year. You got through the House, right?
Actually, 2 years ago, we got it through the House. Uh-huh. And then it went over to the Senate Rules Committee where it didn't get a hearing. And I always say when I talk to members of the public, they always think, well, what's so hard about, you know, this is such common sense. And, you know, this legislation was popular, as we used to joke around, everywhere in New Mexico except for a small slice of real estate called the state capitol, where it was toxic and poisonous, it seemed. But I wanted to go back to that point about the lobbies. I would say, you know, kind of like the legislators and the elected officials, their arguments based on the merits and are, you know, satisfied with winning or losing based on the merits. But there is about 5% of lobbyists who make enormous donations to every incumbent, and they're trying to, you know, win their argument or their legislation based on who they know and their relationships that are built up through these political connections. And then they're the ones that generally end up in these scandals, like Ken Schultz was.
And is that likely to be the larger companies? Can we lay on the table any generalization about larger utilities or larger oil and gas or larger transportation, highway? You know, or does that be much too general?
Honestly, Craig, I haven't done that analysis.
I think it's unfair to just to throw it out there without some support.
I don't know. And usually these lobbyists, they're not the blue chip. They don't generally have the blue chip clients. They'd like to have them, and they think the way to get them is to just layer on, you know, enormous contributions to every incumbent running for real.
Yes? You're,
no.
You're working for the next year's legislation? And is it this bill again? Is this going to be the front piece of your effort?
Well, all of that is dependent. So next year will be a 30-day session, and your listeners may not be aware, but in the Constitution, in a 30-day session, the governor has to approve putting on what's called the call, any bill that's not an appropriation. And our bill, we would argue, would save the state money, but it can't be described as an appropriations bill. So we'll need to get the governor's permission on this bill if we're to bring it back. And we're optimistic. She campaigned very strongly on fighting corruption, and we think we have a good case to make with her. We haven't had that conversation yet, but I'm optimistic that she'll put it on the call. But if she doesn't, you know, your listeners that are familiar with us know that we're pretty stubborn, and when we don't get a recommendation approved in the first year or the second year or even the third year, we bring it back. That was the case with repealing the food tax. That took 3 years of some pretty intense work to get it repealed. And then during the budget crisis, some legislators thought it'd be a good idea to bring back the food tax. So we had to fight it all over again. And fortunately, we were successful with the help of many others, including many of your listeners who wrote emails to legislators and the governor, and I think a total of nearly 15,000. So we're able to stop that. So we'll keep bringing this back. And given our history, I suspect this won't be the last spate of corruption scandals that we have. So we'll be hopefully in the right place at the right time the next time they want to address corruption.
So if the governor doesn't put this on her call, and I'm sure part of your strategy now is how do you get into the office and make the case. And with summer, everybody's trying not to think like this, but think New Mexico's got a full-time staff and it works year-round. So what else are you hoping to focus on this year?
Well, our board – so we've learned from past experience that it's better not to disclose our coming topics until they're released. But I will give you a scoop in, say, September, October, when we'll be releasing our next report. And it's on a topic that I think you would approve of and your listeners would approve of. I'll say that.
So we don't get to know. You're not going to scoop yourself and say, look, if you just knew how – are you researching it? What are you doing with it?
Well,
here's how we'll get at this. Where are you researching this, Fred? What are you researching this all over New Mexico? Are you researching this in the Galisteo Basin? What are you working on?
Actually, all over the country, we're looking at this is a particular area where New Mexico is once again at the bottom, and we're looking at the other laboratories of democracy, the other 49 states. I'm not going to get a scoop today, but I'll let you know in September.
Do I gather it is relevant to democracy?
It is.
Yes, good. And it's relevant to the way our government functions or does not function?
Does not function, yes, correct.
I think I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And you're doing that study right now, and you're going to announce it in September?
That's correct.
And that's lovely. So how, as I mentioned in my setup for this today – the research and the detail is actually the lobbyist's best tool, and to have the capacity to put people to work on a thing like this is itself an enormous achievement. How have you been able to raise money and get people to invest in Fred Nathan and Think New Mexico? How have you been able to do that?
That is a great question. I was very unaware when I started Think New Mexico. I wasn't really familiar with not-for-profit fundraising. And I thought the way that you did it, without knowing very much, was a little bit like Willie Sutton, you know, the famous bank robber who was asked why he stole from banks. And he said, well, that's where the money is. And so consistent with that line of thinking, I applied to all the big national foundations, all the ones that you've heard of, Ford and Rockefeller and so forth, and of course got some very thin rejection letters. And 6 months into this, having raised absolutely zero, I called one of the grant makers. This was the Carnegie Corporation in New York, and said, you know, I'd really like to get some tips on how this process works. And he said, oh, yeah, this is Mr. Levine. I remember his name. I remember looking at his stationery. He says, well, actually, I remember your proposal. It was on full-day kindergarten. I said, that's right. And he said, well, you know, you should feel very good because, as I recall, you were a new organization and you got to the, I think it was the third level of our process. And so I said, well, how many levels of the process do you have? And he said, seven. So I said, well, you know, actually, I don't feel that great about it. And I was wondering if you could just give me some advice. And he said, well, you know, full-day kindergarten, it's really not that sexy a topic. And I didn't have my sensor on that day. And I said, you know, I don't remember sexiness being one of your grant guidelines. And then he, of course, got very defensive and said, well, it's just not just that. But, you know, New Mexico is sort of out of sync, were his words, with the rest of the country. And I had a stationery in front of me, and I looked down and I saw that I was calling him on Madison Avenue in New York City, which I don't particularly think is being in sync with the rest of the country either. So I quickly ended the conversation and had a conversation with a local friend who explained it to me and said, basically, people give to people that they know and trust, and what you are lacking is a full-day kindergarten initiative. And again, with the help of a lot of others, we were able to get that initiative through, which makes full-day kindergarten accessible to every child in New Mexico. And it was a very sort of dramatic victory because Governor Gary Johnson was the governor then, and he had promised that if it reached his desk, he would veto it. And we put on a full-court press, including Dee Johnson, his wife, who was on our side. And we had several Republican legislators helping us, and he changed his mind at the last minute, and that was all over the news. And that really is what has helped our fundraising, and we've become somewhat arrogant. I've always insisted that I would never hire a development director, and we have this attitude that we'll just do outstanding work, and if you do that, people will support us based on our work. And fortunately, it's worked out that way. We've never had a development director. We've never even had a fundraiser. I always hate those things, and I don't want to organize them. So
your brochure, your Think New Mexico brochure, which people can get, I'm sure, if they go to the website, which is what?
www.thinknewmexico, written out as one word, .org. Or if they want to just call us at 992-1315 and just mention Craig Barnes's name, we'll send him a free copy of our annual report and our we'll comp them.
That's great. We have to take a break. We'll be back. We're talking about the way in which public interest can get represented in the combustion chamber of the state legislature, how difficult it is, and what the practical resources have to be put together in order to make it effective, and the staying power with a remarkable staying power person, Fred Nathan. We'll be back after this short break. We're back. You're listening to Our Times on KSFR, and we're talking to Fred Nathan of Think New Mexico. Fred, I see from your brochure that in 1999 you had 52 what you call social investors. I take it those are people who make contributions
That's right.
to keep you going. So in 1999, you're getting this started. You're a young man. you got stars in your eyes and public interest in your heart, and you find 52 people. I bet those 52 are pretty wonderful to come by. I mean,
well, they're mostly friends and relatives.
you went to everybody and said you're going to change the culture, because your whole thing is the fight for reform in New Mexico. It's not just reform in campaign finance or just reform in lobbying contracts. It's reform in schools and et cetera across the board. Your relatives, right. Brothers, sisters, aunts, and uncles. And then the next year, you got up to 135 in 2000, which is quite remarkable. You doubled it.
I think that was the result of getting the full-day kindergarten law passed, and then we got on the radar screen of some others. And I should actually say something about Santa Fe here, because it's really the philanthropic community in Santa Fe that I feel most indebted to, because they were the ones that sort of came to our rescue and saw the potential of a results-oriented think tank. And it was organizations like the McCune Foundation and the Frost Foundation, the Azalea Foundation, Jim and Jeannie Manning, and Philip and Mary Amelia Howell, and of course Owen Lopez, the McCune Foundation, that believed in us before anybody else did. And of course, we're representing the whole state, but really then and now, the bulk of
the people who were willing to contribute or support this effort were people with whom you, first of all, your aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, and sisters, fathers, mothers, children to come.
Yes, all exactly.
You pledged your firstborn son, and I'm sure all of that. But they are people with whom you have a trust relationship, people who trust you and know you. Mm-hmm. And that, as you've said, is true when you're dealing with Carnegie or Ford, or when you're dealing with McCune, or when you're dealing with people locally in the Thaw Fund. So gradually building on that, you created a set of relationships with local foundations that knew Fred Nathan and knew your staff and knew your track record and didn't put you at the bottom of the pile or only at level three or stage three, actually could trust you well enough to bring you up and consider the merits of your proposals. How did you get – I mean, every nonprofit in New Mexico wants to be able to do what you've done. This is a program in part to illustrating how a public interest organization can somehow get its feet on the ground and keep going, because that is itself enormously challenging. I've started the first state organization for Common Cause in Colorado in 1971 in January.
Bless you.
It was the first one. And I had the problems that you're having, and I didn't do as well as you're doing. So you got up to 135 in your second year. But now, in 2010, you have 787 social investors. You can't know them all by first name. You don't know exactly how you got their trust. How did you get from 135 to 787?
Well, I'll tell you a story about that, and I should brag on my staff. You know, because we don't have a development director, we have to be very innovative, so I should mention them. Lynn Buchan is our business manager, and we now have a database of about 20,000 New Mexicans, opinion leaders all across the state, and she's the person that maintains those lists. And Jason Espinoza is our field director, and Jason is phenomenal in teaching me about social media like Facebook and Twitter. We have supporters in 94 different cities in New Mexico. I believe there's 102 or 103. And then Christina Fisher, who's the associate director of Think New Mexico, is wonderful at writing grant proposals. And she and I collaborate on those, but she really does the heavy lifting there and can write a pretty compelling grant proposal. So we don't have any professional development people on staff. We just split it up among ourselves. And then, you know, frankly, the other social investors are pretty good at getting the gospel out and around the state. And so that we should probably define what a social investor is. So my thought process on this is that, that running a not-for-profit isn't much different than running a business. You have to be very entrepreneurial. And people sometimes ask me about not-for-profits that I like and support. And I say, you know, when you're making your donations, you should look at it the same way you might look at a stock portfolio, that you want to get the highest return on your investment. And it should be the same with not-for-profits. Profits in Santa Fe, but it's good to be able to, you know, monitor their work. And I don't find that's as true with these national organizations. I had a when I was working for Tom Udall in the AG's office, my introduction to this was a contributor of a very large gift came in and said that his donation had not been used for the purpose for which it was given, and it involved a big national not-for-profit that had become pretty insulated, and they had basically used it, and it was supposed to be used to purchase land in northern New Mexico, but it had been used instead to purchase land in downtown San Francisco underneath their national headquarters, which was quite elaborate, and that really... And this was long before I got into the not-for-profit arena, but it sort of soured me on some of these national not-for-profits, although there are some good ones out there.
Well, of course there are, and they're doing magnificent work too, and it's part of what I think of nonprofits. I think of Think New Mexico, and I think of Common Cause, and I think of Move to Amend, and the democracy movements, the National Organization for Women, as the substructure which is going to prevent this country from going fascist. It is, while we are in there's a lot of conversation nationally on national radio programs, at least amongst the progressives, that we are facing into the kind of climate that existed in Germany in the early 1930s, and that mm-hmm. we should be careful that we are not taken over by people who are listening to our emails and all of that. While on the one hand, those are real concerns and ought to be. On the other, Think New Mexico is an emblem of the kind of civic public organization with facts and skill that simply did not exist in Germany in the 1930s in any degree. I had my own experience as a civil affairs officer in Germany when I was in the infantry mm-hmm. in the 1960s, and the civil commitment, the idea of civil participation was foreign. It was just not yet embedded. And one could easily understand how Hitler came to power. I think, and there's a reason for making this point, is I think that Think New Mexico and the work you're doing is a part of a network of organizations that keep will keep this country free.
Yeah, we are so fortunate to live in Santa Fe, and I've never been able to document this, but there's a great book to be written if you match up the high quality of life communities in the United States. Invariably, I think you'll find also a very strong not-for-profit sector in those communities. And we're very fortunate in Santa Fe. Another shout-out I'd like to make is the Santa Fe Community Foundation, which really is the backbone of the philanthropic and the not-for-profit community in Santa Fe. And they do a wonderful job of capacity building, and they've helped us with investing some of those monies that we receive from those 787 people. And that's incredibly helpful to us, and why we're able to stay small is that we can sort of delegate that work, which we're not proficient at, to others.
I'm impressed with the list of companies, local businesses that have also supported your effort. You must have been able to couch it in nonpartisan terms. You must, and that must be true. I guess when we're talking about the people who benefit from a legislation that would ban contractors and lobbyist contributions to political campaigns, everybody across the board, Republican, Democrat, all benefit from that, I take it.
That's exactly right.
And so you've been able to get a nice list of Santa Fe and area businesses, Los Alamos area businesses, Santa Fe area businesses. Do you have a program? I'm amazed that you don't have any fund drive person, although you're doing a lot of normal funding work or development. We call it development work. Does it suffer from your list, the kinds of things you're working on? You're working on the end of pay-to-play, which we've been talking about. You're working on small schools. You're working on the secret story behind New Mexico's title insurance law. You're working on individual development accounts. All of those involve a great amount of legislative detail. How do you keep the public aware without having them have to master the details of every one of those? How do you say we're reforming New Mexico politics? How do you make the link?
Well, I want to come back to my staff. Christina Fisher is the associate director, in addition to writing great grant proposals and helping, you know, being the lead person on research, also is our webmaster. And so we work very hard on taking these complicated issues. And so I'd really encourage your listeners who are interested in some of these topics, whether it's full-day kindergarten, the food tax, strategic water reserve, they're all, you know, one page on our website. And if people, the way Christina has worked the webpage is it gives you sort of a terrific overview. And then if you want more information, there are links to our reports and so forth. So it's that's basically how that gets addressed.
Santa Fe has been swept up in a debate over the Sequoia Madre. Maintaining or doing away with Sequoia Madre Elementary School in East Side Santa Fe, huge fight. Probably had to do had an effect on the re-election of Mary Ellen and the non-re-election of Mary Ellen Gonzalez and Frank Montano in the last school board elections. And because there's such a protest to keep a Sequoia Madre, such an outpouring of support to keep a Sequoia Madre, as it is a small school. Mm-hmm. And you I think that Mexico weighed in on that fight. And what is the case for, I mean, instead of four music teachers, and you can maximize efficiency by having a big school, right?
Well, that's actually a case where we lost, because we also tried to fight. We won on a Sequoia Madre, but we also tried to fight the closure of Connie, Laragoite, and Alvord Elementary, 77% free and reduced lunch. And the short answer is that small schools, whether they're elementary schools or high schools, have much higher student achievement than do their larger competitors. And there's good reason for that. Let's take high schools. If you look at dropout surveys of people that have dropped out of school, the two reasons that they give overwhelmingly, one will surprise you, one won't. One is the just tremendous sense of alienation these kids feel. And then the second is that they simply don't feel safe. And larger schools have less opportunities because, you know, there's only five starters on the basketball team, whether your school is 3,000 kids or 300 kids. And that's replicated over any number of extracurricular activities.
That's great. I went to a small school, and I was a starter on the basketball team every year because there were only about 10 of us all together.
Well, Stuart Udall, who is the chairman of our board until he passed away, same thing. He grew up in St. John's, Arizona, and there were only five boys in his graduating class, so everybody had to play on the basketball team. They won the state championship without anybody on their bench. None of them could come out. And I asked him how that was possible, and he said, well, since we grew up and we knew each other so well, that it was a terrific advantage. And it's the same thing in schools. Schools, as you know from being the chairman of the board of the girls' school, which is a terrific school here in Santa Fe that serves, I think, 45 girls, 6th to 8th grade, that's an enormous advantage. And one of the reasons that school, I think, is so successful is all those kids feel that they're known by every adult in that school. And they feel safe, and they can focus on learning, which, of course, is the bottom line. That these more moderate-sized high schools have higher graduation rates. And the same is true in elementary school, if you look at scores and so forth. And that's why I think it was such a tragedy that the last school board, close those schools. And I think it played, frankly, a big part in Mary Ellen Gonzalez losing her seat and the other two choosing to retire when they saw the public mobilizing. And, you know, in that last election, we had triple the normal. And the need to reform our public schools. And I'd love to come back sometime when you need a guest and talk about our public schools and some of the reforms, not just smaller schools, but there's a ton of other things that we need to be doing in our public schools.
I grew up and I went to walked across the wheat fields to a school which had, we had three classes in the same room. And my fifth and sixth grade was one row in each class. I felt like I was the cat's pajamas. I was somebody in seat three in the third row of the fifth grade. And when I said to the teacher, I'm staying home because my chickens are hatching this morning, she didn't have to say, well, get a note. She said, okay, Greg, that's interesting. That's probably as interesting as what we're going to do today, so go home and watch the chickens hatch. Mm-hmm. So it was like that, and I think that's a metaphor for small schools in general. Yeah, they do produce. So we have to wind up here. We're out of time. Fred Nathan, Think New Mexico, thank you so much for coming. Your website is, again,
www.thinknewmexico, written out as one word, .org. And great. Thank you very much for having me, Craig. I always enjoy visiting with you on the air and off the air.
Great to have you here. We'll be back next week with another interesting program.